But it's good to be back with you, and I hope and pray that we're going to have some good times together this week. I look at gospel meetings as, I call them Kodak moments. You know what a Kodak moment is? Some of you have no idea what I'm talking about. But Kodak moments, there's actually a thing called cameras, and you used to put film in them. And you could take pictures, and you have them developed, and 21 out of the 24 would be black, you know, and the other four you could actually do something with. But you take a picture of something that was memorable to you, and you would put it on the refrigerator or someplace, and it would be a moment where you would always remember. You wanted to give thought to what happened at that moment. And I call gospel meetings Kodak moments only because you're going to forget me, and I'm going to forget many of you. But on the day of judgment, when we have perfect memory, that we're going to be able to remember what got us to heaven. What got us to that place where the Lord said, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of the Lord. And we're going to be able to look back on moments in our lives, Kodak moments you might call them, where we remember days and weeks and maybe a sermon or somebody that spent time with us and helped to bear our burdens, lessons that we learned that got us over the hump at that particular time in our life and kept us moving forward. And gospel meetings are like that. I know there's a lot of people that are giving up on gospel meetings. They're just not doing them, or they're doing just a short weekend meetings and things like that. And that's fine. But just look at the idea of spending 5-6 days together, studying the scriptures together, praying with one another, singing with one another. Those are moments that at the moment you might not think much of. But in the course of time, they are something that just, I mean, I went over to the Romines last night and ate dinner. And we had a wonderful Southern meal. It was great. But you know, a week from now, I might not even remember what I ate. But I'll tell you something. All that nutritious food that Sister Romine made is right now working in me. And it's giving me nutrition. And I'm not thinking about it. Well, I am now. But that nutrition's in me, and it's giving me vitamin A and vitamin C and all those various things that keep me healthy. Same going with gospel meetings and things like what we're doing right now, and the times that we shake each other's hand and we look each other in the eye and maybe silently say to ourselves, I love you. And the feelings and the fellowship that comes together with moments such as this. I hope that you will look at this week that way, that this is a time where God has said we assemble together to provoke each other to love and to good works. And we spend this time building each other up in the most holy faith. This is a fantastic moment for our lives, and it will be a stepping stone, a Kodak moment on the day of judgment. I hope that you'll be able to one day look back on the other side of eternity when we have joined together with all God's singers, and we are together in forever and ever in heaven before His throne. And it'll be moments like this that got us there. Don't ever underestimate what an assembly of God's people will do for you in your life. And I'm grateful for the elders inviting me to be with you again. That shows you that they're either forgot what was like when I was here before, or they're gluttons for punishment. Either way, I'm grateful for their invitation, and I pray that we will spend some good times together. Is this what I'm supposed to be using? All right. Where are we going with this?
Turn it on.
Turn it on. See red. I'm not a bull. Okay. Are we getting there? Hey, success. The meeting moves forward. Let me just talk in this Bible class time with you about something that is of great interest to me anyway. I get a blog. James Clear writes this blog, and he sends it out every Thursday, and I just am fascinated by it. He is a man who's always trying to motivate people to be successful in whatever endeavor they have in their life. And so I read a lot from people like that. And recently he had an article in there that he was studying from Napoleon Hill. I don't know if you know who Napoleon Hill is. He wrote a book many, many years ago, Think and Grow Rich. And it's one that was obviously built on the success through finances and gaining a fortune in your life. And in his lifetime, he knew a lot of very famous people. He knew Andrew Carnegie, he knew Henry Ford, he knew Thomas Edison, and he interviewed these men ad nauseum. I mean, he spent a lot of time with these men. And he would interview them and try to get to know how their minds work that would lead to success in whatever adventure that they got themselves into. And he would study prolifically and read prodigiously the lives of men like Abraham Lincoln and others like that, trying to get to know them. And so what he did, he got together and he put together a cabinet of believers, or a cabinet of wise men. And he wasn't himself a very religious man, and so that wasn't what motivated him. But I'll tell you, as I began to read that, I looked at things like a passage, Proverbs 13, verse 20, a man who walks with wise men will be wise. Passages like I see here in Philippians 4 and in verse 9, when the Apostle Paul said, whatever things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, do, and what's the result? The God of peace will be with you. Now, that's what I want in my life. I suppose that's what you want in yours. All of us want to find peace. All of us want to find happiness and joy in our lives. We're all in search of that pursuit of happiness that the Constitution tells us about. But just the idea that if I can find certain people in my life to mimic, to imitate, to be a part of, to try to pick up where they were and to be successful like they were. Of course, we looked at Napoleon Hill and what he did, or and he would take these men that he would interview or people that he would study and read from, and he would just ingest all of their lives and the things that they could learn from them. He just spent all of his time reading their biographies, autobiographies, others who wrote about them, things like that, and then interviewing the people that he was able to go and see and talk to. And then he put this book together called Think and Grow Rich, and it has sold millions of copies and made Napoleon Hill very rich. But look at his list of what he called the Cabinet of Invisible Counselors. And I was fascinated by this, and I got to thinking about that from the spiritual viewpoint. And I want to share that with you this morning in our Bible class. When he got together and he talked about men like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who he knew, Luther Burbank, who he knew, but he didn't know Lincoln, but Edison he knew, he didn't know Thomas Paine, Charles Darwin, he didn't know him. But he knew a little bit about Teddy Roosevelt. Napoleon Bonaparte would have been before him, but he studied his life, and he wrote, in fact, a number of books about Bonaparte. Henry Ford and Andrew Carnegie he knew. And so he would interview these men, or he would read from these men, and he would come up with, every night before he would go to bed, he would gather them in a council around his bed. He would sit on his bed with propped up with his pillow, and he would be the chairman of the board. And he knew their lives so intimately that he would ask them questions. Now, if I'm in this situation, Henry, what would I do in this matter? Or if I'm weak in this area, and he goes to the Carnegie and he says, Andrew, what would I do in this situation? And he would then, he was a kind of a psychedelic, and he would come up with, he got to believing that he was actually in these with them, and he got scared, and so he stopped them for a while. And then one day he had a dream, and Abraham Lincoln came to him in his dream and said, you need to reconvene. And so he started doing that. I don't know what Lincoln was doing telling him that, but just the idea that he gets them all together and he starts interviewing them, and he became a very wise man in the ways of the world. Now his counselors were not going to get him to heaven, and that's for sure. He put together another list, and you can see some more, Socrates and the Apostle Paul, and even Jesus Christ, Confucius. You can see that he put together quite an eclectic group of people. But he would then study their lives. And I was fascinated by that because one of my joys in life, I love history, and I read biographies and autobiographies all the time. I'm constantly reading two and three and four at a time at home. You can ask my wife that, she just, you know, I always get new books and reading about the lives of people. And they're fascinating. But I try to read a lot of the lives of spiritually minded people. But to look at that, and I think about my own life, who would you get? And again, he puts it this way. I regard my cabinet meetings as being purely imaginary, but I feel entitled to suggest that while the members of my cabinet may be purely fictional and the meetings existent only in my own imagination, they have led me into glorious paths of adventure, rekindled an appreciation of true greatness, encouraged creative endeavor, and emboldened the expression of honest thought. And I thought, well, why can't I do that? And I realized that I'm not as creative as this man would be, but why couldn't I do that? And so I put together my own cabinet that I talk to on a regular basis. And I do that simply by reading their lives and studying what they wrote. And I'm talking biblical characters, by the way. All of them are biblical characters. I've convened my own cabinet. And I'm going to encourage you to this morning to think about possibly doing this, because I believe the Bible tells us to do that. When the Apostle Paul said, imitate me as I what? Imitate Christ. He said that 3 or 4 times in his epistles. And then he said in Philippians 4 and verse 9, the things that you have heard and seen and received in me, do, and the God of peace will be with you. God put that in the Bible for us to look at Paul's life and study his life and imitate his life as he imitated Jesus Christ. And so I've convened 4 from the Old Testament, 4 from the New Testament, and I'll tell you why I did that, because I have a lot of weaknesses in my life, and I'm looking for strengths and how to strengthen those character traits in my life to be more like my Lord Jesus Christ. I didn't put Jesus on my cabinet of counselors. He was perfect and he had no weaknesses. And so I was looking for men who I could imitate, who would imitate Jesus Christ and try and get stronger by the doing of it. And so I want you to be thinking about, before I put my list up here, who would you pick? If you could pick 4 from the Old Testament, who would you pick? Now, all of mine were men, because I'm a man. And I wanted to find their strengths and that would help me in my weaknesses. Many of you ladies out there, obviously, you could pick some good ladies that could help you in whatever you're looking for in your life. But I want you to think about that. 1 Peter 2 and verse 21 says, for this you were called because Christ suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow his steps. Obviously, he's the chairman of your board. He's the one that you're going to go to and look to imitate in every aspect of your life, because he's perfect in every aspect. But then what do we do if we put together our cabinet of counselors? I started with the Old Testament, starting with the passage in Romans 15 verse 4, where it talks about the things written before time were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. And that's what we live by. We're saved by hope. Romans 8, 24 tells us that. And I wanted to have that hope of getting stronger every day. I want to get wherever I'm weak, wherever Satan is probing and prodding to get me. He's stalking me like a lion, and he is looking for every weakness that he can prod and probe that he could then seize on to bring me down. And I don't want him to be able to get me. I want to be able to put on that armor of God and resist every fiery dart of the wicked one. To do that, no, I know I got to work on that particular area of my life. I'm going to show you what I'm talking about as we go through, hoping that it inspires you to do the same thing. I started with Noah. And let me tell you why. When I put this together, my job in life, my number one priority was to save my family. And I could think of only really 2 characters in the Bible that I saw that would really be that. Abraham was one, and I'm not going to go into detail on that. It talked about in Genesis chapter 18, verse 19, God said that they saw through him that he would command his family after him, and that what he would do with his wife and his kids would be able to lead them to a higher calling. And he was a friend of God, as the Bible would say. But also I picked Noah because as at that particular moment in my life, I looked at Noah's life and I saw in him something that was there from Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 7, where it says, by faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household. Now, I know that was physical, but also you can look at his life and what can you also determine? Was his wife faithful to God? Whereas there's 3 boys, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, were they faithful to God? In the midst of an immoral, where the thoughts and the intents of man's heart was evil continually, Genesis tells us. How in the world did that man get his family into that ark and saved? That was an amazing thing. As righteous as Lot was, his family turned against God. Even his wife and his family, his sons-in-law and all of them, they turned against God. But we look at Noah and we can see that here was a man who did something. And so even though there's not a lot to study about what he said to them and what he did with them, we know that through hundreds of years, centuries, his family saw in him something that they wanted to emulate. And so you study, there's enough about Noah and given in the Scriptures that makes it interesting to say, why don't I look at this man's life? And even though I don't know a lot of details about it, I want to be just like him. And you're looking at endurance, certainly. You're looking at somebody that every single day is going to do the right thing. He's going to command his family after him. And he's going to try to do the best he can, no matter how hard it was, to build that ark to save his family. And he did that. In Genesis chapter 7, the Lord said, "Come into the ark, and you and all of your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation." That generation was pathetic. It was immoral. And yet, in the midst of all of that, he remained faithful. And I said, "God, help me to be like Noah. Help me to do that." And so, even though I don't know how he would answer all of my questions, I gather him into my little cabinet of counselors, and I ask him, "Noah, help me to think about this." And I know he can't answer. I'm not going that direction. But I am simply saying, help me to look at this man and help me to think about what he would have done in situations like this. Noah with his sons, his wife, his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. What a glorious day and moment that must have been to Noah when God put him in the ark and then closed the door and it began to rain. He had saved his family through all that time in his life. He was 600 years old. Imagine 6 centuries remaining faithful to God. And his kids saw that and said, "Dad, we're going to be like you." And his wife followed him, and they were saved. And how he must have felt when that rain began to lift that ark. All his other family and friends that would have been outside that ark, and he would have had a lot of them, and they were all perishing. And his family, though, was saved. And I'd like to think on the day of judgment when my wife and my kids and my son-in-law and daughter-in-law and others are and my grandchildren are all saved, that it was because of moments like in my life where I was in the midst of a trial or temptation. I did not give in to the wickedness of Satan and to the temptation, and I remained faithful like Noah did and saved my family. And so when the fire comes instead of the rain, that my family would be saved. And Noah is going to be a hero to me, and I want to meet him when I get there and tell him, "I want to shake your hand because it was you that helped get me to this place with all of my loved ones around me." I pray that. And so as I think of Noah, I also think of Job. He's on my counselor. I have read that book so many times because of moments in my life where I just needed Job to come give me inspiration. Come give me example. Come give me something that I can learn by patience. I'm an impatient man. I pray to the God, "Give me patience and give it to me now." Are you that type too? Give me patience now. And I'm just so impatient. I want things done now. And I got to learn to be more patient and enduring in the midst of unknown trials. There's always going to be something today or tomorrow that's going to be unknown to you at the moment. And it's going to put you under test. You're going to be tested as by fire, Peter tells us. And I sometimes so stumble and fall to those temptations that what I long for is to be like Job. Job didn't see it coming. He was blindsided. I mean, he had everything going his way, and all of a sudden the rug's pulled out from under him. His life is turned upside down and inside out. And through that whole reading of the book of Job, all 42 chapters, you're going, "Oh, Job, if you could only see what we can see. If you could only know what we can know, you wouldn't say those particular things, or you wouldn't get so upset." But he never cursed God. And that was the whole trial. That was the bet that he had with Satan, that God had with Satan. "He won't. I know my man. He won't." He says, "Yeah, he will." "No, he won't. I know him." And so you can only imagine, even though we didn't get the third story of Satan coming to and fro and coming up and tell God, and God finally says, "Satan, I told you. I told you Job wouldn't do it." He never did curse him. I mean, he questioned a lot of things. He doubted a lot of things. He wondered and asked a lot of questions, but I'm all right with asking questions. I don't mind him doubting. I don't mind my people doubting, but I want them to keep with an honest investigation to keep going forward. And Job never would. He wouldn't let his wife persuade him otherwise. He wouldn't let his three friends, comforters, persuade him otherwise. He stuck to his guns, and he had that dogged determination that he says, "I know that one day when I stand upon the earth, my Lord will save me." He believed that, and he said that out loud. And so as we look at his life, James gives us a perfect divine commentary looking back on thousands of years of history when he said, "Indeed, we count them blessed who" what? "Endure." You've heard of the perseverance. The old King James puts the patience of Job. And seeing the end intended by the Lord. That's one of my favorite verses in the New Testament. That God had a plan, And if Job at the end of his life could look back and say, Job, was it worth it to lose your 10 kids, to lose all of your possessions, to lose everything? Was it worth it? And now he'd live to see to the fourth generation, his kids, grandkids, great-grandkids, and he could see through their lives. They could look back on Grandpa, or they could look back on Great-Grandpa, or upon Dad, and they could say, he's been faithful always. And his life will be an example for generations yet unborn. His life would be that which would live on in eternity for all we know. And we look at that and say, the Lord was very compassionate and merciful. And we look at that and go, he wasn't seemingly very compassionate and merciful during that trial, but we can see what God did with that. God had an end intended by what he did there. It wasn't arbitrary. It was planned out by God that he wanted us to be able to look at that life. And so my job is to put him on my counselors and constantly look at his life. And in any moment where I'm going through a test of tried by fire, like he did, that I'm going to be like Job. If I have to, I'll go back and read that book again and again and again and again. And by doing that, it has got me through so many unknown trials in my life. Let me tell you, I put this council together about 11 years ago. And I've been talking to these guys and thinking about these guys ever since. And I want you to think about maybe putting him on your council when you look at his life. Ezekiel had something many years later. Anita and I have been studying the book of Ezekiel together every morning. That's depressing. Very depressing to look through that book and to see what that guy went through. But one of the things that's noticed there is in chapter 14, verse 20, or verse 14 and verse 20, even if these men, he names it three times, Noah, Daniel, and Job. Now think about that. God is telling Ezekiel, coming in, he's off into the sitting by the river Kibar up in Babylon, and he's talking about these three guys, Noah, Daniel, and Job, and he mentions them three times. That God puts them on his A-team list and says, consider these guys. Go back and look at Noah and Daniel and Job. So I put them on my counselors, by the way, because of that. And to look and say, they would only deliver themselves by their righteousness. These men, God is basically saying they're in heaven. We know Moses and Elijah are going to be there because of Matthew 17. And we look at Noah and Daniel and Job, and Ezekiel is telling us they're going to be there too. God's already kind of given us the divine judgment of what their lives was like. They're there and telling us that here, we by patience of the Scriptures, we can have hope. And so we look at Job's life in that regard. And then, of course, he mentions that several times. You already know the story there, and as he mentions in Job 1, verse 1, and then again in verse 8. But then let's move on to Daniel, since he was on my list. Why would I pick him? Because one of my great weaknesses in life is my prayer life. I do not pray like I ought to. Oh, how I want to be a man of prayer. And Daniel, of course, he stands out. We sing it from the time we're children. Daniel was a man of prayer daily, prayed he three times, even when they cast him down in a den of lions. I've sung that since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. Daniel was a man of prayer, but he was also a man of purpose. And Ezekiel again reminds us, God saved that man. In the midst of all those many, many years, 70 years at least we know from the time that he came into Babylon all the way to the Persian Empire, Daniel was faithful unto God. Well, there was something that made that man faithful unto God all those years. What was that? He purposed in his heart. He was a man with a plan. He had a purpose in his life, and he said, this is what I want to do with my life. He was probably 15, 16, 17 years old when he's hauled off out of his homeland into a strange land, strange culture, strange languages, everything. And yet through it all, he was a man that says, God's number one in my life, no matter what. If I end up in a den of lions, or if I end up in a fiery furnace, or whatever happens to me, I'm going to be faithful to my God. Well, we see what God did with that. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's portion. And you know that story. But I want you to think about that for a second. We move on into the Persian Empire. And there again, he's comes up, and the whole story is he's been placed again in a high place, and the others are very envious and jealous of him. And you know all that story. And then they have the king sign the decree that you can't pray to anybody but the king. And it talked about there, he says, and in his upper room, after he knows that everything had been signed, sealed, and delivered, he goes to his window, he opens his windows up, and you know what he does. He gets on his knees and he bows before his God, looks probably toward Jerusalem, and he prays three times that day. And of course, they're gonna nail him with that. And the king, of course, tries to save him, but he gets thrown into the lion's den, and we know the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. Custom from early days. And so I want to say, what made that man a successful counselor to kings and examples to all of us? And that is, he had purpose in his heart, and he prayed three times every day. He set aside time. He didn't make it arbitrary. And so that's been kind of my goal ever since I put him on my counselor. When I go to bed at night, I try to think of Daniel. I said, Daniel, what would you do right now? What's going to keep you out of the fiery pit? What's going to keep you out of the lion's den? What's going to save you? If it doesn't save your body, it would save your soul. What would save you? And he would say, pray, Rick, pray. From early days, pray. And sometimes I just forget that. And so I talked to my friend Daniel. I call him my friend. And I ask him, Daniel, what would I do? What should I do? And he says, before you pray, before you preach, before you do anything, you pray. You ask God, bring him into it and let him lead you. So I've done that. And the last one is Jeremiah. You think, well, that's interesting. Why did you pick Jeremiah? Well, it's because I'm a preacher. And this man for 40 years, one of the hard things a preacher will ever go through is to preach the word in season and what? Out of season. It's easy to preach in season. It's hard to preach out of season. And I've put myself in that position many times where you're standing before an audience and they're out of season. They're not with you. They're not on your side. What are you going to do in a moment like that when you got to preach a hard sermon that you know they're not going to appreciate? You got to do the right thing. You got to stand up. And so when I look at Jeremiah, here's a man who says, the word of the Lord came to me saying, before I was formed in the womb, I knew you. So he knew from the get-go, here's my life. My life is going to be that of preaching. And so what did he do? He was faithful in the midst of that. I love Jeremiah 9, verse 1 and 2, where it talks about, oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. He was a man who had a love for souls, his own people, and he would do anything and everything to save them. And yet, through it all, they weren't going to turn. In fact, they were going to turn on him. Oh, that I had a wilderness, a lodging place. He just sometimes says, I don't want to say this. I don't want to preach this. I don't want to go through this again. And you know what he did? And I said, I will not make mention of him nor speak any more in his name. I'm just tired. Tired of the miry pit. Tired of all the negativity. I'm tired of all of this. But his word was in my heart like a burning fire shut up in my bones. And I was weary of holding it back and I could not. That's preaching out of season. And I want to remember men like Jeremiah when the chips are down and when I don't feel like preaching that sermon. I don't feel like going to that home and sitting across on the kitchen table and telling these people, you can't live like this anymore. And I know the reaction I'm going to get. It's got to be like a burning fire in my bones that I cannot contain. And I'm weeping for them, but I'm not going to withhold. I'm not going to let that emotion stop me from telling what needs to be told and preaching what needs to be preached. And so Jeremiah becomes one of my great heroes. Well, then I move on to the New Testament. And there's all kinds of men that I would pick, and you can think of all kinds of people through the New Testament that might be on your council that might not be on mine. But I'll tell you why I picked the ones that I did here. When I come to Peter, what's the word that's often used about it, Peter? Peter was what? Impetuous. Do you know what that word means? It means he's got foot and mouth disease. He opens his mouth and he speaks when he hasn't engaged his mind. He does things without thinking. He's one of those guys that just leaps before he looks. And that's Rick Lanning. I fly by the seat of my pants. That's kind of my world. You can just ask my wife and kids. Dad just leaps before he looks. He just kind of does things. And that's just kind of the way I am. And so Peter becomes kind of my hero because of how many times he did that and he sought and needed forgiveness and God came to the rescue. And Peter constantly was being restored by Jesus. Jesus, I'm sure many times, is going, Peter, not again. And I can see him doing that with Rick Lanning. Rick, really? Again? But I'll tell you, what possesses Peter to do what he does is because he wants to be a leader of men. He is always front and center, isn't he? And the doing of that, it got him into trouble, but it also got his name in the New Testament an awful lot. And I'm not looking for the prestige, obviously. I'm looking for the example of what he did in leadership roles. My dad always taught us that you need to step up. You need to speak up for Jesus Christ when he needs somebody to speak for him. And so to do that, sometimes you're going to get yourself into a mess, but I've got to do that. And so I look at Peter and I said, look, we're going to see over and over again. I mean, look at these examples. Peter. Explain this parable to us. He, out of all the 12 apostles, comes up to the Lord and says, tell me what you just said. Explain that to me. Peter comes up and says, Lord, how often my brothers sin against me and how often should I, you know, the other apostles are probably thinking that, but Peter had the gumption to go say it. We see that again. Peter answers and says, see, we've left all and followed you. You know, that guy's walking away sorrowful. But look at us. We've left all. He wouldn't sell his goods and go follow you. But we will. Look, we've already done it. What do we get? And so there's Peter. And then turns right around moments later and rebukes the Lord for saying, I got to go to Jerusalem and die. And he says, look, but who do you say that I am? And Peter, of course, says, I mean, me. He goes, you who smell like a fish. What is it? He goes, blessed are you, Simon Barjona, because you confess me to be the Christ, the Son of the living God. Man, I want to be like Peter in that regard. I want to be the one who steps up and says, when he needs volunteers, I'm here. I'm going to make some mistakes. I'm going to fall on my face. I'm going to hit a rake and it's going to hit me in the face. I'm going to do those things, but Lord, I'm going to be front and center. That's what leadership does. You put yourself out there. And if you're going to be an elder in the church, you're going to be a gospel preacher, you got to do some Peter things. That's kind of what you got to do. But if you want to be a leader, you've got to do that. And so, yeah, sometimes you're going to have to be told by Jesus, get behind me, Satan, you're an offense to me. And I've had that happen many a time. I'm sure the Lord would have said that to me. But I want to be forgiven by the Lord. And so many times I know that as many mistakes as I've made, especially in leadership roles and preaching, I've been an elder since 2006, and I've made a lot of mistakes, a lot of bad decisions. But I'll tell you, through it all, I felt what Peter felt when the Lord finally on the Sea of Galilee after the resurrection pulls him aside from the other apostles and he says, Peter, let's go for a walk. And he goes for a walk and he says to Peter, Peter, do you love me more than these? Yeah, Lord. Peter, do you love me more than these? Yeah, Lord. Peter, one more time. Do you love me more than these? Whether it's talking about fish, whether it's talking about the other apostles, whether it's talking about whatever it was. And he said, Lord, I'm not going to jump where I'm not looking. You know that I love you. Whatever you know my heart better than I know my own. Tell me, what should I do? And he says, feed my lambs. And from that day forward, we know from 1 Peter 5, he even became a shepherd, much less an apostle and a preacher. Peter became what God wanted him to be. And I'll tell you, as I look back at the end of my life, 30 years later, he's writing 1 and 2 Peter, and you just cry when you look back over the biography of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and say, Peter made a lot of bad mistakes. But yet through it all, look what happened to him 30 years later. And that's what I'm asking of God. Get me where you want me to be, no matter how many rakes I have to step on. Get me where you want me to be. And Father, help me to remember you forgive me. You forgave me. And you continue to tell me to feed my sheep. Feed my lambs. That's what I want to hear from my Lord Jesus Christ. What about John? Did I miss one there? Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one whom Jesus loved. We know that's probably with John when he's writing about himself. He never mentions himself, but he's talking over and over again about the disciple whom Jesus loved. I want to be that intimate with my Lord. And that's what I'm talking about, why I want him on my council. I want to be intimate with my Lord. I want to be so close to him that out of all the people that he could see, that he would choose me to want to walk with him, because he would see that I love him so deeply, that I'm so in love with Jesus, that he would want me around him that much and put me into his inner circle when he needs to heal a person or go up on a mountain and be transfigured, that he would want me among his best friends that would be with him, that he would allow me to stand at the foot of the cross with his mother and he may be able to look down and say, I trust you so much, Rick. Would you take care of my mom when I'm dead? I want to be that disciple. And John through all the things that he went through in his life. He was called in the early days one of the sons of thunder with his brother. His anger would say, you want us to call down lightning and kill these people in Samaria? He said, you don't know what spirit you're of, John. And there's so many times when I know the Lord has said that to me. Rick, you don't know what spirit you're of. You need to grow up. You need to get better at this. And so I feel an intimacy with John, who's seeking an intimacy with the Lord Jesus Christ. And I want to be that disciple whom Jesus loves. And I want that. And so there's going to be times in my life where I've got to go through some times with the Lord and see some things and make some dumb statements like, Lord, should we build some altars here on this mountain transfiguration? And I mean, that was kind of, they didn't know what to say. They were afraid. And go into places and to see, children being raised from the dead and having that inner circle. But I want to be in that inner circle with Jesus Christ. And the point is, I believe in the scriptures we can be. Every single one of us can be in his inner circle. We can have that intimacy with Jesus where we know his life so well. How many of us spend so much time reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that at any moment if they say, Luke chapter 17, you know what's in it? Can you tell me what's in Luke 17? Can you tell me what's in Mark chapter 14? Probably could, crucifixion. But can you tell me those things? Do you know his life? Have you studied those four books so much that it's just a natural outflow of who you are because you want to know Jesus so much? And that's what Jesus is looking for. John 21 tells us, Peter turning around and says, the disciple whom Jesus loved. You said that I'm going to be carried out and die. What about this man? He says, well, if he lives forever, then what's that to you? And the point being, John is the one who lived this long life. His brother James got killed early in Acts chapter 12, and yet John, of the other apostles, lived the longest, most likely, and he probably lived into maybe toward the end of the first century. And through all of that endurance is what I'm pointing. He was so faithful and intimate with Jesus Christ that no matter if he lived young or lived and died young or lived long, that he was going to be faithful to the Lord, and that's what I want. I want to know that if I get older, about to turn 70 not too long from now, or if I had to die young, Lord, help me to be faithful to you all my days. So John had spent his life touching and as he writes it, I believe he wrote later in life, probably around 90 AD. And he says, the things that we've seen and heard, we've touched him and all that. And he was still as if was still walking with the Lord, as if he was still there. And he says, that I write these things that your joy may be made full. And that's my job from God is to help you to know Jesus so intimately that I can say to you what Paul did, imitate me as I imitate Christ. That's a scary thought if you know me very well. But I'm asking you to look into my life and imitate me as imitate Christ. So, what about Paul? Yeah, you got to get him on this council. I mean, there's so much to read about him that you can feel more intimate about him as you go through the study. The passion that he had for not only the Lord Jesus Christ, where he would make statements like in Philippians chapter 3. Look, I give everything up, all that I would have ever had. He says, I would easily sacrifice it and throw it on a dung heap that I may know Jesus Christ and the power of his resurrection and all the things about his life. I want to know Jesus intimately. And so he becomes passionate about his faith in Christ. But then, certainly as we begin to look at his life, when he says, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain, that's what I want in my life. But then he says, and my favorite verse of Paul of all of them is in Galatians 2 and verse 20. I have been, and he can say it with a straight face, I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. We are so intimate, we're so tight, and I'm so passionate about him that I would do anything for him, including giving my life. And then we know the passage in 1 Corinthians 9. Though I'm free from all men, I've made myself a servant to all. Oh man, wouldn't that be something that you could say in your life? I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means just save one, much less some. I would do anything in my entire life to save one person. If at the end of my life, the Lord looks at me and he says, Rick, because you lived, that person went to heaven. Would it be worth that sacrifice in your life? And that's kind of what our Christian life is supposed to be like, is I live my life not in looking back at all the mistakes and all the sins and the things that I lived in my life, but to be able to say,
My life was worth it because that little girl grew up to become a Christian because of what I did for her. That little boy, I lived before him and I showed him the way and I taught his Bible class and things like that. And Ann Howell was that to me. Ann Howell's been dead a long time, but Ann Howell is my first grade teacher. And because Ann Howell, I became a gospel preacher. Ann Howell is just a dream to me. She was just a little old lady. Nobody else would have given her a second thought as they walked down the street. But Ann Howell was my hero, still is, because of what she taught me. Taught me to sing, "Daniel was a man of prayer," "Jesus loves me, this I know," all of those things. She changed my life. She saved my soul in so many ways. And I want to be able to be, just save somebody's soul. And that's what Paul is telling me. Things like that. And then finally, Barnabas. We'll quit here in just a moment. He was an encourager. Wouldn't it be great to be able to be, take the 12 apostles, to get together and say, you know that guy, Joseph? That name just doesn't fit him. Let's change his name to Barney. Let's give him the name Barnabas. Of course, Bar is the son, was the term in the Jewish world of son of. And Nabas means encourager. So he's the son of encouragement. And let's name him Barnabas. And that'd be cool. These guys walk up to you and says, Joe, you're not even a Joe anymore. It's Barnabas. And that, think about how he would feel about these inspired men are telling me that I'm the son of encouragement. Well, you know his life. You can look at it and see what he did with all the people that he met, how he changed the lives of so many. John Mark would have never wrote the Gospel of Mark if it hadn't been for Barnabas. He would have been so discouraged that Paul rejected him on the second missionary journey that he would have never probably become what he became. Barnabas made John Mark in so many ways. And so as you look at his life in Acts chapter 11, he was just a good man, full of faith. Everybody can do that. You can just be a good person, full of faith and of the Holy Spirit. And I want to just get him together. And here's a man that he was, you know, when they first began, it was called Barnabas and Saul. Barnabas and Saul, Barnabas and Saul, three times. But as you go through the book of Acts, what happens? Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas, Paul and Barnabas. You think Barnabas is okay with that? Yeah, he was okay with that. He was all right with that. He could play second fiddle. He didn't care. He played third chair if you wanted him to. He was just a man who says, whatever I can do to help the kingdom to grow, I'm in. Whatever I can do. And that's what he became. And a great many people were added to the Lord because this good man of faith. And that's kind of what I want to be. I don't want anybody coming up and having to pat me on the back and say, you know, you're great doing this or that. I just want to be somebody that the Lord can use to make a difference. So I want to talk to Barnabas as I talk to Paul and Peter and others. So as you look through their life, you can see some of these things. John Mark and others were blessed because of this man's life. Well, let's go ahead and finish up here. What about you? I want to ask you this question. I'm asking it with all seriousness. You've seen my eight, who I talk to on a regular basis, and I try to emulate in some aspect of their life to strengthen my weaknesses. Before we get out of here this morning, I want to ask you to put together a cabinet of counselors. Think through, in the Bible that you know, who would you put on your council? If you want to just put one in the old and one in the new, start simple, do that. But find some people in the Bible you can study their life and say, by reading their life, like Romans 15 verse 4 says, the things that were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. That means studying their life, looking at what these guys and these women could do in their lives and how they could change my life. He put it in there for that very reason, so that we can find the good traits or the bad traits to resist and the good traits to emulate and make them our counsel. Thank you for your time.